is it? The captain, right? Does what? Right. For some reason, he fails to properly steer the ship. Okay, so we've got to work out whether this intervening behavior should count as superseding. There's one thing in the fact pattern that I want you to note. They keep saying that the captain is an independent contractor. Why do they say that? Why do they keep focusing on that? Yep. Really the ship owner's person, then this is what you pick as the negligent behavior. If it's the plaintiff's captain, it's their ship, their captain, then it's their fault that their ship sunk. Okay, so that's why it keeps saying he's an independent contractor, because it has to be an independent third party. That's why we have this problem. Excellent. Okay, anyone try and analyze why this is or isn't superseding? So you can make arguments from common law presumptions, and you should make arguments from foreseeability of the intervening act given defendant's breach. So you can all cheat if you want and see what the court held. What did the court hold? It was superseding. So we know they're going to say it's superseding, so therefore they're off the hook, right? So, type of argument, yep. So you think it's not superseding, that's what you're arguing, because medical malpractice is not superseding. Medical malpractice is not superseding, remember? Okay, so remember there are two ways to make the argument. What's the first way to make the argument? I don't know, I've lost the sheet from last class. Find the sheet. Yes. What's the first way to make an argument, Mr. Chasing?
There's no foreseeability.
That's the second way, but we could go second way. But this is the first way. What's the first way? I don't know. What's on the top of your sheet? And we've got to pick what to characterize the intervening act is. Remember those common law presumptions. So how would you characterize what the captain did? What do you think? She says it's negligent. If it's negligent, what presumption do we have? We don't have a presumption. We have to go to the foreseeability rule. And I want to say, I think it's more than negligent. Anyone actually read the little note? Right now, read the little note. What's the court say?
Did he intentionally decide not to
do the ship? Yeah, but intentionally acting, remember, isn't enough to give you an intentional tort. Right, so it's true, he intended to act. I don't think it's intentional. What does the court actually say about it? I don't know. Last line. Gross negligence. So what does that look like a little bit more like? Do you think that's less superseding or more likely to be superseding? More likely to be superseding. So this court seems to say, hey, it's gross negligence. And so our inclination is to say, well, that's not intentional or a crime, but it may be climbing towards reckless or something. So our first hint from the common law rules is that no presumption, maybe a little push towards superseding. Already see? So the first thing we've done is we've fixed our brain on what we think the result's going to be. Now we need to argue the foreseeability rule. So what are we asking is foreseeable? Is the... No! No! Check the next bit of your sheet. What does your sheet say to us?
What's the intervening act is foreseeable in light of risk created by these people?
Is the what foreseeable? Is the intervening act foreseeable? So what would that be? Right, is the captain not steering the ship foreseeable given what? What's the last part of the sentence?
Given the defendant's breach.
Which would be allowing it to float away. So to decide if this is superseding, we have to ask, is this intervening act foreseeable given the breach? So what do you think? If you were doing this breach, would you foresee the intervening act? Yep.
Yes, it's always a possibility, even if he wasn't there, that someone may not have steered the ship.
So what did you just say it was? A... Now I heard your first word. It's always a... But is that enough? No. Excellent, right? Because we're talking about reasonable foreseeability. Okay? So what words describing what the captain did push you towards the fact that you wouldn't foresee them? Yeah?
Gross negligence.
Well, that was our label. But I'm now going into the facts because we're actually doing analysis.
He had ample opportunities.
He had ample opportunities to steer. Anything else?
Inexplicably.
He inexplicably ignored what? Standard procedures. So that looks unforeseeable given your breach, right? It looks like given your breach, allowing the ship to float away, it's not foreseeable that a captain would inexplicably disregard standard procedures when he had ample opportunity to implement. So see why it looks unforeseeable. Okay, so the one way you can tell if you can master a concept is, what facts would you change to make the intervening act foreseeable? You're master of the fact pattern. Change one fact. Change one fact. The captain's activity has to be foreseeable.
He was sleeping.
Do you think that's foreseeable?
No.
No, it's not. So remember, we're asking when the defendant breaches, what we want to make the captain's conduct in steering away foreseeable. Yep.
So there's storm, there's
waves. Storm waves! Okay, so he has trouble steering. Anything else, even simpler. What words do they use? So what did you, word did you just change that we highlighted before? Now we know, right? It's explicable, right? Oh my goodness, there's a storm. He might steer improperly. What other word can you change?
Ample opportunity.
To?
To. He didn't have ample opportunity.
A few seconds, he has to make a split decision about how to steer the ship. Right, all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, that's foreseeable. Do you see? If you change the facts, all of a sudden you can foresee the captain making an error about steering. Do you see that? You good? But the facts we're given, this decision by him seems unforeseeable. We don't expect if you have ample time for no reason, you'll just disregard standard procedure. If he's really facing an emergency, he has split seconds, then the defendant should foresee that the captain may act negligently and it won't break the chain. Are you good? Do you see it? You see how to argue it? Are we waving? Please wave. Waving, not drowning. Yep.
So why in a malpractice case are we willing to say it's foreseeable that doctors will screw up, but in this case, we are not able to say it is foreseeable that the captain will screw up?
So it may be that med mal, right, we're always wanting to get back here for policy reason. So for that reason, we say it's foreseeable that doctors will screw up. It might also be that we believe that operating on a human person after they've been brought into the emergency room, we can foresee that things won't go perfectly. We can foresee negligent acts. Or it may simply be that we've made a policy choice. But notice this one looks more like, did this look like regular negligence?
No, it was gross.
It looks like gross negligence, right? And the malpractice rule is just regular negligence. Okay? So that could be another explanation. Yes?
If you did change the facts to a storm and he didn't have enough time, would the captain be liable?
Well, we're going to presume that he's, you could argue he didn't breach at all, in which case he's down to just stupid, right? right? He made a stupid decision. There was a better decision he could have made, in which case, notice, we've lowered the common law presumption and we've lowered the result. We could say he's not even negligent, he just makes a bad choice, right? And we'd say, oh, well, that's not going to be superseding. So excellent, so you're lowering it on the common law presumption and because the facts are lowering when you apply foreseeable. Yes?
With the defendant, the breach, would it be okay to say, allow ship to float away with a capital award to make it a little easier to connect the dots of it not being foreseeable, but then a ship with a capital award would float away?
Correct. I mean, so this presumes that there's not an empty ship, right? Because
okay.
If you foresaw an empty ship floating away, then this would be completely unexpected, right? So,
okay.
Yeah, you're right. In that presumption,
so you can. Like you can say that.
Well, that's because those are the actual facts. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's try the next one. So then, because we're next one. Let's try B. Okay, so I'll do it. Car maker is the defendant. You gotta find the breach. What's the breach? Why don't you want that car? It stalls without warning. Everybody agree that would be a negligent manufacturing or negligent design of the car. Okay, well, let's go to the injury, because remember we always have to link the defendant's breach with the plaintiff's injury. So what's the injury? Car crash. And we're like, well, yeah, this makes sense to me. Car crash while stalled, right? It looks like a perfect match, right? What's the intervening act? By R. Yep.
He wants to see if his SUV can damage it, so he just intentionally
ramming SUV. No judgment there. Okay, so let's try the common law presumption, which is simply a characterization of the active behavior to give us a little hint. So how would you characterize the intervening act here? Reckless. And I want to go further than reckless. Intentional, right? He deliberately decides to intervene. So I think you can go all the way up to intentional. What's your hint, therefore, about what's going to happen when you run the foreseeability test? It's going to, we think, so first we label, which is what the common law likes doing. It goes, oh, looks intentional to me, right? And so we're like, we think superseding. That's our first instinct. How about whether the intervening act is foreseeable? The second inquiry we have. Is it foreseeable in light of defendant's breach? Yep.
I just have a quick question. Because I feel like it turns, if you say it's foreseeable that a car may hit the stalled car in the intersection, that may be foreseeable. But if you say it's foreseeable that someone will intentionally hit a stalled car in the intersection, I think it changes.
Bingo. So it's how you describe this intervening act. So what kind of intervening act do we have here?
You said intentional, criminal, so therefore it is superseded.
Right. His breach, you don't foresee someone, it doesn't increase the risk of someone's driving into you intentionally to try and take you out. So it looks, when we apply the foreseeability act test, that this intervening act, someone intentionally ramming you, has nothing to do with this breach. See it? Like, they could intentionally ram you because they don't like the color of your car. It doesn't seem to turn on the breach. See it? The breach doesn't increase the risk. It is a cause in fact, right? You need the car to stall before he makes that decision, but the breach doesn't make the intervening ramming foreseeable. You're all looking at me as if you're it brain dead. How about this? Okay, you're the planning department of the car company. Hey, you know, our car might have a problem stalling. Do you think that's a problem? Answer.
Yes.
Why do you think that's a problem? What do you think is going to happen?
Somebody's going to come and intentionally wreck their car.
What kind of lunatic are you? No one's going to intentionally intervening act. But what we have here, the ramming SUV, is not foreseeable given the breach. Now, do you see it? So what fact would you change? The SUV collides with it because? They can't brake in time. They were checking their radio. Oh, people don't listen to radios. They were texting, right? And they were distracted. There wasn't a clear distance. As soon as you change it to that, it's an absolutely foreseeable injury in the end.
In that case, though, it makes it look as though as long as the act that comes in between is intentional in any situation, then that automatically makes the original defendant off the hook. So you're saying in any situation, if the intervening act is going to cause them on purpose, and if I intentionally do something, it's going to get that other person off. It doesn't seem very
so clear. What does the common law presumption say? It absolutely definitely is, or it usually will. Intentional? It usually will. That's exactly why courts like the rules, because they come to the realization you came to. They're like, you know, anytime I've seen an intentional act, we always think it's not foreseeable. So let's just have a little rule that says intentional acts break the causational chain. So exactly your realization, oh my goodness, most of the time, if there's an intentional act, it's not foreseeable, is exactly what causes courts to come up with those cute little rules. Now the problem, you said, is never. Right? And never is not correct. Sometimes you can foresee intentional acts. Sometimes you can even foresee criminal acts. That's why we have to always run this underlying test just to check up. So that was brilliant. You were like, oh, yeah, I see the pattern. And the courts are exactly with you. We see the pattern. That's why they have these little presumptions. But you always have to run this to make sure. Good. Yes.
How does superseding causes relate to preemptive causes? Like, I mean, is it just...
Oh, you mean cause and fact?
Yeah, like, will it specify...
Well, if you have a preemptive cause and fact will always have taken out the actor anyway.
Right, so it just...
So you'll never get to proximate because you're a failed cause and fact.
Okay.
Right? Because remember, preemptive, it's already dead, so the second one doesn't cause anything. So if you fail cause and fact, you're not meant to be into proximate cause. Yes?
So basically, as far as with the foreseeability, it's going to be a scope issue as far as what is outside, or is it outside the scope of what a reasonable person would?
Yeah, except this time you're asking is what outside the scope? The intervening actor. That's why it's a slightly different focus from your regular scope of the risk inquiry, right? Because the first scope of the risk inquiry asks if the harm matches. And does the harm match? Yes. The problem we have with linking them is we have this other actor. So you're right. We're always looking back to the breach to try and say, can we link? But here we have a different problem. Yes.
So there's really two scopes that you're looking at, one for the injury and one for the intervening.
Bingo. So most courts care both about the type of harm and a little bit about whether something intervened.
Could it be something completely unrelated?
So I don't know how to answer that.
Like, the scope may cover both things, but...
You could have a double problem.
Right.
Right? So when we look when you write the third thing, you will see a fact pattern where there is no problem with proximate cause that's not offered by the fact pattern. Yeah, so you could cha-ching all three of them. You could have a harm problem, a risk over problem, and an intervening actor problem. Right? So you could have all three going off at the same time. Because that's law. Okay, let's do the last one. Because we have to get onto whole. Okay, let's do the last one. Okay, I'll fill it in because that's faster than dragging it out of you. Okay, so the breach, and this is an interesting breach. The police officer gives chase in a suburban area, right, for a petty crime in violation of the department's own regs. So there are actually very precise guidelines that most police departments have. Don't give chase in suburban areas for petty theft, because you're more likely to take someone out, and the crime doesn't matter that much. So his breach is that he violates the department rules by engaging in a car chase for just petty theft. Okay, the plaintiff's injury, who's the plaintiff? They're a pedestrian who's hit by the car, by the stolen car. Right? So what's the intervening act? The intervening act is the driver who seeks to avoid capture by driving on the sidewalk. Okay, so everybody identified the intervening act, and we have to decide, are we going to treat it as superseding such that it breaks the causational chain? So our first step is to look at those presumptions, right? The judge goes, I've seen 1,000 cases like this, and the answer is, it's a... What category are you going to put it in under the common law presumption? Criminal, right? Last time I looked, no driving on sidewalks. Everybody agree? So we actually have a crime. So what's our presumption based on that? It's superseding, and you can't get back to the officer. Okay, now here's a real interesting one. Do you think the intervening act is foreseeable given the breach?
Yes.
Yes, exactly. So I think the court gets this one wrong. What was the breach? He shouldn't have. Why shouldn't he have chased it?
Because
it's foreseeability that even the police car or the fleeing criminal will injure someone. What was the intervening act? He drives on the sidewalk injuring someone. So I think the court is wrong, right? That this is not superseding when you do an analysis, even though our little presumption tells us it should be. See that?
So we can say that.
You should be able to say the common law presumption would indicate superseding, but an analysis of foreseeability would suggest the opposite result. That would be brilliant.
I think it would be foreseeable that because the officer chased, I guess, that he was trying to use any way of not getting away from him.
Right, because why was it wrong to chase him?
Because it only had one regulation.
And why was the regulation in place? Because there was too much risk if you chase it. All right? Everybody good? Okay, let us take a stab at Hull. Okay, this is easy. Now we're going to move to Hull, which is hard. Okay, Hull is not really hard, it just pulls things together. Okay, so it's kind of a horrific fact pattern, right? So we're on 351, right? And what I want to do with this case is review what we've learned about proximate cause and also do a little review of duty. Okay, so how duty interacts with proximate cause. So I'll do the facts. Lamb, the rapist murderer, and his friend Shuley are drinking at the bar. They meet Teresa Hull. When Shuley steps out, Lamb starts to make advances to Hull. The bartender at this point, an employee of the defendant, Fosdettis, realizes that Hull is drunk and cannot stay on her bar stool and asks Lamb to take Hull out of the bar, right? Lamb puts the victim, Hull, in the front of Shuley's car, and Lamb goes back to the bar. Shuley drives home, goes into his trailer, passes out, and leaves the victim, Hull, passed out in the front of her car. Right? Lamb stays at the bar drinking, then gets his six-pack to go, drives home to find his wife, who's not there, and then he drives to find Shuley. Right? When he gets up to Shuley's trailer, he finds the car with the victim unconscious, so then he rapes, shoots, and murders her. Okay. So who is obviously liable for the victim Hall's death?
Man.
And why aren't we suing him?
Because he has no money.
Because he's in jail, right? So everybody see, this is a typical case where we want to get back to a different defendant, not because we don't believe that the criminal actor Lan is liable, but because he will offer no recompense to the victim or the victim's family. Okay, there are two basic ways that the victim's estate tries to recover from fast edits, right? The Dram Shop Act route and the common law duty to protect, okay? And I want to actually take them out of order. So you should see there's a section on the Dram Shop, and then there's a section arguing there's a common law duty. Okay? So, let's first look at the Dram Shop, which is right at the end of the case. Right? So it's page 354 to 355. Okay. So in Monday's class now, we're going to see that a statute in a doctrine called negligence per se can give you duty breach. So that you can use a statute as sort of a free pass past duty breach. It's a different way to get through duty breach. You can go common law, or you can go, I have a statute, and you get right through duty breach, okay? So that's what they're trying to use here. They're trying to use the statute to get them through duty breach. So can someone explain to me what these Dram Shop Acts are? They've got quaint names, kind of Scottish, actually. Oh, Dram Shop Acts. When were they passed? In the notes. Prohibition, because what was the devil rum doing?
Men wouldn't have died and they wanted to
Bingo.
Sue the company or the sellers of the alcohol so that the bereaved so they could recover for loss of income because they're saying it was the bar's fault. Sometimes they would even push it back to the person leasing the land.
Okay. So as they originally came out, they allow these destitute little kids, oh, where is daddy? Why is there no food? Right? They allow whole family members to sue the bar that caused the death of the breadwinner. Right? So that's what they're originally doing. Today, what fact pattern is it that causes us to use the Dram Shop Act? People who get hit by drunk drivers. So it's no longer that the drunk somehow kills himself. It's now that the drunk gets out of the bar, in their car, heads down the road, and hits some innocent victim, right? And the victim is suing the bar. Everybody see it? The victim of the drunk driver is suing the bar. So that's the predominant use of those statutes today. Who is it under these acts who are covered? So the legislature's made a decision that you should be able to sue who? Anyone?
Commercial
sellers. So almost all of these statutes target commercial sellers or licensed sellers of alcohol and not who? Social hosts, right? Generally, these statutes do not impose a duty on a social host, only on a commercial seller of alcohol. Do they say that these commercial sellers are liable whenever someone gets drunk? Or what are the triggers for liability in these statutes? What is it the commercial seller has done which triggers liability? Continuing serving alcohol when the plaintiff is visibly intoxicated. And usually it's a subjective test. They know they're visibly intoxicated. There's one other person you're not meant to serve. Minors. Or they served a minor. So most of the time the Dram Shop Act is only triggered for commercial seller either
provides alcohol to someone who's visibly intoxicated or to an underage guest. Okay? In contrast, as the notes tell you, most states have rejected social host liability. Right? And the only caveat is some states have social host liability if you serve to minors. Right? And you actually often find it's a crime. You shouldn't put on a party for those 16-year-olds. Right? No matter how much they want it. Right? So you may well trigger liability under a serving alcohol to minors crime as a social host, but generally not under the Dram Shop Act. Everybody understand them? Okay. So we're looking at section 3 on 354 to 355. And defendants Fast Eddies makes an argument on summary judgment, even if I served Lamb when he was visibly intoxicated, I should not be liable because of what? So we got through duty breach using the Dram Shop Act, so what element are they arguing about? Proximate cause. They say even if we did serve Lamb when he was visibly intoxicated, we're not liable for Hall's death because there's a proximate cause problem. So if you look at the middle 354, let's do a little bit of review. How does the court describe proximate cause? Proximate cause is what? So we're looking at the second last paragraph from the bottom of 354. Yeah? So they use that old, they love that language, right? Natural and probable. Our problem is, I don't know what's natural and probable, right? But they love using that phrase. But they also use what?
Reasonably foreseen and anticipated in the light of the circumstances.
Which is what test? Foreseeability. They use a general foreseeability test, right? They say we're going to measure proximate cause by using foreseeability, reasonably foreseeable in light of the circumstances. Okay. What common law presumption do they say? Anyone spot? So what's the most obvious problem here with proximate cause? Intervening act, right? We have an intervening actor. So what common law presumption do they give us? Criminal acts break the causational chain. You're like, oh yeah, look, they're doing their little, oh, I didn't give us a sheet. I know that common law presumption, right? So they're like, criminal acts are break the causational chain. So they give you, as courts typically do, that common law presumption, which they love. Okay. The court gives three reasons why it thinks there's a proximate cause problem. 354 to 355. And what I want you to try and do is decipher what they mean. So anyone give me the first one on the bottom of 354. Proximate cause fails because what? So tell me what it says, yeah?
That it was later.
Excellent. So notice the court doesn't actually use those words, but I think you correctly ascertain what problem the court has, right? The court says, look, it was too tenuous a link. First he goes home, then he goes to visit his friend, then he finds her. Too tenuous a link. And so instead, it looks like an argument that the risk is over. So when would you say the risk created by the bar was over? When they've all left the bar, right? Okay, while they're there, hey, have some more, yeah, good, good, good. But they all seem to go their separate ways. So at that point, you could say, okay, the bar did create a risk, but the risk was over. The connection to when she gets injured is too tenuous, the court says, because the risk is over. Yep?
I just have a question. Could you at all say the risk was over once he re-enters the bar without Hall anymore?
You could try and argue it earlier, but they don't need to do that. Right? They've got like, oh, he goes home, he looks for his wife, then he goes, right? You've got a really good risk over. So you don't need to push it that much earlier, though you could try. Yep?
Wouldn't the risk over not occur when he left the bar, but rather when he got home, since the point of this is if they're drunk driving, you can still get them?
Except we're not we're not trying to. So I agree with you. There are multiple points where you can pick the risk is over. Some are more aggressive, some are less aggressive. But the court's like, it's clearly over much, much before the rape murder, which is all they need to do. Okay? Let's try the second argument on the top of 355. So top of 355, they say, additionally. So what's the second proximate cause problem they point to? So notice they also play an intervening actor card. They say you've got a problem connecting the breach and the injury because you have an intervening act who's a criminal. Do they seem to run it as simply a presumption, or do they look at foreseeability? So how they do?
Presumption.
What do they say?
Well, they just say that it broke the chain.
Right, they just say Lamb's intentional acts were an intervening cause that broke the chain. So this court seems to treat those common law rules as like, oh, we're done. We're not asking foreseeability. We're just, hey, it's a criminal act. We're done. So see how they want to treat those presumptions more as an absolute rule rather than as something you then ask foreseeability about. Okay, they have a third argument, usefully headed, finally. Okay, so what's the final argument? So someone tell me what the court says, and then we'll try and work out what role it thinks is problematic. So what does the court say?
They say that it's not a proximate cause of Paul's death. That the estate submitted that the intoxication caused him to shoot Paul.
Right, and who testified to that?
Lamb! He said it was I'm the nicest, greatest guy in the world. It was just the alcohol that made me rape and murder her, right? So that's what he testifies to, right? He says the intoxication caused me to injure her. So that's the argument that the plaintiff makes. The plaintiff says, look, he admitted the alcohol made him do it. And what does the court say in response? This could be a wrong type of harm. Why?
Because it wouldn't be.
What would be the right type of harm? You serve them alcohol, what would be the right type of harm?
Like they could get in a car accident.
Bingo. So the court says, look, the reason it's a breach serving them alcohol is because the right type of harm I'm looking for is a car accident, and what do we have? A rape murder, and they're like, that's not, we don't say, please stop serving them because you might rape murder someone, right? No, we're like, stop serving them, right? So it might be a type of harm argument. Everybody see it? So it might be that the type of harm is wrong. Type of harm, right? The reason we condemn their conduct, their carelessness, is because of the risk of drunk driving. It's not because of the risk of rape murder. So therefore, it's the wrong type of harm given their breach. Yep?
Is it possible to argue that the alcohol wasn't even an actual cause because he was just...
Cha-ching! 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 Drunk? So what is the other argument they may be raising right here? And why is it not the actual cause? Why is the alcohol not the actual cause?
Because there's no, the intent to kill would have still been there whether there was alcohol.
Right, so the court says, we think alcohol, he rape murders. No alcohol, he rape murders. We don't believe that the serving the alcohol had a factual causal link. Absolutely. I think you can read the court as saying that it fails cause in fact. Even though they don't spell that out, that may be their problem. They believe that the harm's going to occur whether he's given alcohol or not. Okay, everybody see how they went through and they looked at these different proximate cause problems and decided proximate cause was not met. Okay, yes. Surely the guy who, because Shuley lives in a trailer.
Yeah,
would be my best guess.
Well, I mean, like,
so there's no money.
My guess is they don't really have a case against.
They don't have a strong case against anyone, and they at least have a dram shop violation against the bar. So no, they don't have a good case against anyone. And right over in common law duty, so let's do that, and then you should see why the case against the friend is problematic.
Okay,
so let's go see how, so dram shop, they get through duty breach because they have the help from the statute, but then they fail on proximate cause. So let's look over here, their other argument, which actually comes first, is an argument about their common law obligations. Okay? So.
One quick question about the statute. Would they have to prove the statute first anyway? And they couldn't really do that, or?
Okay, ask me later, because I need to like keep going, and I don't know what you're asking. Okay, so let's go to common law. It doesn't mean it's not a good question. It just means it's not working with my brain. Okay, so the second claims are based on the common law. So they appear at 353 and 354. Okay, so what duty is the plaintiff arguing?
Duty to protect, easy or hard?
Hard,
right? They want, you have a duty to protect her.
So it's a hard duty. So how do they argue there was a duty to protect? So let's actually take the second one first. 353 to 354. Anyone work out 353 to 354, what argument they're making as to why the bar owed a duty to protect?
They're saying that they had, by the gratuitous or voluntary assumption, like when they told Julie to take her out of the bar, saying that that was like a voluntary act, that they were trying to protect her.
So what exception that we saw before in rescue are they trying to trigger?
Start to rescue, voluntary undertaking, right? They say, hey, look, you owed a duty to rescue her with reasonable care because you started to protect her. And you did a lousy job. You're like, hey, Lamb, why didn't you take her out? You're like, that's a bad way to protect someone, right?
So, why does the court reject that there's even a duty? So the court says, no, we're going to find you don't even have a duty to protect. You can't get through that hard duty door. Why?
Yep.
They said that by just telling someone to figure out what's an action on their part. They didn't actually act.
They didn't actually act in a way that was a...
So, and you're right, just spell it out a bit more, that was a... They didn't take any affirmative step to start rescuing her. Right? They just say, hey, you, why don't you take her out? They don't actually take an affirmative step towards helping her, and therefore we won't find a duty here.
Can you alter the facts so that they would have a duty to protect her? So what fact would you alter that would trigger a duty to protect?
Somewhere that works, the bar takes her out.
Right, he's like, hey, Fred, you know, bus boy, you take her home. Oh, great, duty to protect. So that they don't take any affirmative step that starts undertaking to protect or rescue her.
Why is the court so unwilling to say that asking someone else to take someone home is sufficient to trigger a duty to protect?
What are they worried about?
They'd be required to be responsible for everybody that leaves the bar.
Everybody who left the bar, right? We don't want to make them guarantors of the safety of every departing patron. So they say it's not enough to pick up a voluntary undertaking. So that, right, voluntary undertaking, starting to rescue, failed. You can't get through duty. How else do they try and get a duty to protect? Yep.
Had knowledge that he drank, that the second of increasing that he was carrying a gun, or that he does carry a gun.
There's something else, because that won't get you there. What's the starting trigger?
Drink.
Nope.
One says that the Tarrano's patron duty to exercise reasonable care to protect them from foreseeable acts of other patrons.
So tavern only owes a duty of reasonable care to their patrons. Now, you could write that in your little book, or you could go, wait, I've seen that before. What is that? You don't have a tavern owner rule. I'm going to bet. So what is it? Invitee landowner, right? A landowner owes a duty to rescue and to protect. Right? So what case did we read where the landowner had to protect a patron? Taco Bell, remember? They had to go ahead and rescue, okay? Equally, landowners owe a duty to protect invitees. All the time, or is there an exception? So look at the rule that the court sets up on 353. You do owe a duty of reasonable care to patrons, except for... Uh-oh, it's not looking good for the plaintiff, right? Because what she's suing over, an unexpected criminal attack. So are we done, or what does the rule say next? Unless, so there's an exception to an exception, unless what? Unless the criminal attack is reasonably foreseeable. Right? So this court is saying that a landowner owes an invitee a duty to protect, which includes to protect from criminal attacks, if the attacks are reasonably foreseeable. Okay, so how is the plaintiff arguing that this attack is reasonably foreseeable, which is where you were? Okay, and what does the court say? Not enough to make rape, murder reasonably foreseeable. What else have they got? The bar was known for having fights and assaults, and what does the court say to that? Enough or not enough?
It's not relevant to one person.
So what would change the fact that would trigger landowner liability?
Maybe if he had previously been in like 4 or 5 fights at that bar himself.
Bingo! And she even upped it?
And second harassment.
Bingo! So then you're all saying, well, now the bar owner should reasonably foresee danger. So see the game we're playing? Okay. We have one last thing to do, and I will just lecture you through it right now. Sorry. One extra minute. Okay, so notice it fails here. So here's the question. Why don't they just run proximate cause right there under the common law? Right? Because they know there's a proximate cause problem over here, so why don't they just say there's a proximate cause problem over here? See my question? And the answer is because there is no proximate cause problem right here. If you can get through duty, there is no proximate cause problem. You're looking at me going, why? Here's my question. What would their duty be when we fix the facts? He previously fought with and harassed women in the bar, so he owes a duty. What duty did the bar owe? A duty to?
Protect.
From what?
Foreseeable criminal acts.
Bingo! We're in proximate cause. What's the problem? Unforeseeable criminal acts? Answer? No, because we foresaw them, right? The very reason we imposed the duty was because we foresaw the criminal acts. So if you can get through duty to protect, you don't have a proximate cause problem. Because their duty is to protect the plaintiff from the very thing that materializes the criminal attacks. Awesome, eh? Okay, tomorrow I guess we'll start off doing the sheet on landowner liability, which is doing this problem all over again. And in addition, station, we'll do the outlining exercise. Go your lovely ways, and make sure you vote.
Bye.